This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the audio mind space where you, me and top experts come together and inside 28 minutes wrangle a big issue. Today, more than 40,000 people have died in Turkey and Syria after the powerful earthquake that hit the region last week. An act of God, certainly. But did this earthquake have to be quite so deadly? The overused word devastated is for once entirely justified when applied to the aftermath of last week's earthquake in Turkey and Syria. 40,000 people are estimated to have died, mostly when the buildings in which they were sleeping collapsed upon them. But how much of this suffering was inevitable, and how much avoidable had apartment blocks and houses been properly constructed? And what does the disaster mean now for the politics of the region? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start with the science. Joining me in the briefing room is Stephen Hicks, a seismologist at the Specialist Earthquake and People Interaction Centre Research Unit at University College London. Stephen Hicks, can I ask you, what specifically physically happened with this earthquake?
Turkey is no stranger to large earthquakes. Earth's outermost layers, so what we call the crust and upper part of the mantle, are divided into tectonic plates around the world. And where those plates kind of rub against each other or collide, those are where we expect the biggest earthquakes. Now, what's the sort of main driving force in the area of Turkey is that we have the Arabian plate, basically the Arabian Peninsula with Saudi Arabia and countries like this. That plate is plowing northwards into Europe and Asia at a rate of about 11 millimeters per year, so about the fraction at which our fingernails grow. But Turkey is getting in the way of that collision and has to sort of escape westwards. And that escape is sort of accommodated along two faults in the region in Turkey. One is the Northern Anatolian Fault. It sort of is extending east from Istanbul. But where a recent earthquake happened was along the East Anatolian Fault, which accommodates sort of that northwards motion.
This is referred to at the moment as the Turkey-Syria earthquake. Where would we locate the epicentre? We always talk about the epicentre. And does that matter?
The epicenter is just a specific point on Earth's surface projecting up from the earthquake. But when we get to such large earthquakes, like magnitude 7 and above, like we've seen, the epicenter sort of no longer matters. Actually, the epicenter almost becomes this sort of very extended sort of line almost that encompasses the entire part of the geological fault that's ruptured. And so in this case, because we've got the Arabian plate colliding northwards, we have mainly horizontal motion across the faults. And so it's a bit like ripping a piece of paper from the epicenter, so the rupture initiation point. In the case of the recent earthquake, that crack or that tear in the paper is extended for about 400 kilometers over the period of about 100 seconds. And in UK terms, that's roughly the distance from the Severn estuary to the Humber estuary. So it's a huge, huge extent when we really put it in those terms. And then that is the reason why the damage and strong shaking was really across such a wide area.
Now, there's an assumption that the higher the number we attach to an earthquake, the more problematic the earthquake will be. Is that always true?
The magnitude of an earthquake essentially tells us how much of the fault moved and how much it moved by. If you have a larger portion of fault moving, then that generates stronger sort of seismic vibrations or ground vibrations. However, you could have a very large magnitude earthquake, say a magnitude 8, that occurs at a great depth, several hundreds of kilometers deep beneath the sea. Now, no one's going to feel that. It's not going to create a tsunami. So what really matters is where the earthquake was located relative to sort of land and relative to people nearby. So the other number we use is called the shaken intensity level. This is a scale of 1 to 10. And in this case, the shaken intensity level was around about level 9, so pretty much the highest levels of shaking we see. And that's because the earthquake was at shallow depth, so about 10 kilometers depth, even extending up to the surface. Over such a short distance, just the energy from the seismic waves doesn't have time to sort of to decay, or it doesn't have the distance to decay. Therefore, you end up with this really strong shaken intensity level.
So a shallow earthquake essentially is worse.
Yes, nearly in all cases, shallow earthquakes are the ones which cause, you know, devastation and cause buildings to collapse.
Now, in terms of the devastation, I take it the time of day that the earthquake hits, given the speed that you were talking about there, mattered a lot. Remind us what time it did.
The earthquake happened in the sort of early hours of the morning, local time in Turkey. And of course, most people were asleep in their houses at this time.
If we put all those factors together that you've been talking about, the strength, the depth, the location of the epicenter, the time that it happened, would you say that this was a particularly horrible combination?
Yes, certainly. I would say it's sort of the worst case scenario. I've been a seismologist since about 2011, and I think this is the worst earthquake that I've seen.
A lot of us have seen films in which a seismologist warns about something happening and is ignored. Were seismologists worried about the possibility of earthquakes in this region?
Sadly, we can't predict earthquakes as yet. And when I say predict, I mean to pinpoint exactly when and where an earthquake will be and what magnitude it will be. So we can't do that yet. But nevertheless, Turkey is a region that has had earthquakes before and has had and has been identified as a region of high seismic hazard. Certainly, there was some knowledge there that earthquakes like this might happen. In particular, there was a scientific study I found from just a few years ago where this fault that ruptured, the East Anatolian fault, sensitive GPS measurements had identified that this fault that ruptured was basically sort of locked and primed for rupture. So that if you couple that with the lack of large earthquakes like this on this portion of the fault over at least 100 years, then you can build the picture that this region was at some point due to experience a large earthquake.
Do you think we will ever reach a point where we can predict when and where an earthquake will happen?
Predicting on very short timescales is going to be a difficult challenge because the more we look into these earthquakes with better methods, the more complex they look. But what we can do, we can maybe forecast, a bit like a weather forecast, but we could say in this given region, we are going to have, let's say, a 60% chance of a magnitude 7 or greater earthquake in this region over the next 30 years, for example. What we can do in the short term is there are technologies called earthquake early warning now in certain parts of the world where much less destructive waves, seismic waves coming out from an earthquake can be identified and characterized and then used to sort of predict when the stronger shaking will arrive. And that can sometimes give people seconds to maybe get under a desk or to get outside of a building that might collapse.
So basically, you either get 30 years warning or you get a few seconds.
Hopefully, we can take a two-prong approach and go for this sort of long-term preparation approach, plus hopefully in the future, give some people a few seconds of warning time, which can really help.
Stephen Hicks. Now I want to find out more about building design. Dina Diala is Professor of Structural Engineering and Co-Director of the Earthquake and People Interaction Centre at UCL. Dina Diala, a high number of the collapsed buildings look to have been built very recently. Were they?
Here there is an important factor to consider. The urban migration and expansion that has been occurring in Turkey over the past, basically, 25 years. This has resulted in an incredible increase in the building of residential housings. Most of the construction industry in Turkey and the construction building stock is in reinforced concrete so that they can withstand the shaking without failing. When we look at the building stock in Turkey, the quality of the materials and the quality of the construction really depends on the rapidity with which the industry developed.
Yeah. So in other words, it's the rapidity with which the concrete industry was building in Turkey that may have lent itself partially to the scale of this disaster.
Possibly, because clearly the expertise, know-how, and experience of the contractor can only be limited by the fact that the industry is burgeoning and they need more and more new companies coming in. You know, the system works with subcontracting different activities. Every time that you subcontract, there is a little bit less control, and so on.
A lot of press reports have referred to the fact the earthquake provisions in Turkey's building regulations are actually strong. So my next question has to be, do you think those regulations were actually followed in the case of the residential buildings that collapsed?
It's difficult to give an answer without further investigation. When we look at the way that buildings have collapsed while building next to them are still standing, then the question arises why one is completely collapsed while the other one is still standing. In this case, sometimes there are problems in the foundations. Sometimes there might have been changes in the architectural layout, which might introduce weaknesses. It depends on the quality of the ready mix concrete that comes on site. Sometimes that quality might have not been as robustly assessed as it should have been.
What you're talking about there is all kinds of ways in which possibly the codes and regulations weren't actually followed in practice.
Yes, or let's say that they were not adhered to rather than not followed.
Now, are there countries which are prone to earthquakes where you believe that actually buildings are routinely built to seismic code specifications and therefore are much less likely to this kind of disastrous consequence?
Certainly for many years, the construction industry in California or New Zealand and similarly in Japan, much more of the construction is in either steel or timber. Usually they are not such high rise. But certainly the construction process and the quality control on the construction process is quite different than what we would see. But in countries with lesser economic development, such as Turkey.
Are you saying that if you lived in an earthquake area, you would rather be living in a building made out of steel or timber than you would a high-rise building made out of concrete?
Yes, possibly, especially if the buildings are not high-rise, that would be a consideration to make.
Dina Diala, events like this have consequences that go well beyond the immediate need for relief. So what are the political ramifications for the countries affected? Let's start with Turkey. Ferdevs Robinson is a journalist and analyst specialising in Turkish affairs. Ferdevs Robinson, last week was far from being the first big earthquake in modern Turkish history, was it?
No, it isn't. The last big one was the 1999 earthquake in the northwest of the country, which is a much more industrialized and prosperous part of Turkey. And it killed about 17,000 people and destroyed quite a large area. So, no, it wasn't. But there were a lot of similarities to what we had about a week ago.
And following that earthquake in 1999, what conclusions were drawn about Turkish building practices?
The Turkish construction is not well controlled and well regulated. I mean, even if you build a really good building and it is done properly according to regulations, people tend to change things. They cut columns, for example, supporting columns, or they add another story to their building. And if these things are not well controlled and regulated, that also causes damage to buildings. And we've seen the effects of that, buildings pancaking, literally coming on top of each other, making it impossible for people to survive.
What did the government do following that earthquake in 1999?
An earthquake tax was introduced. And for more than 20 years, that tax was collected.
Who has to pay it?
Every individual who owns a property has to pay that tax. But that tax was clearly spent. But there was no accountability. All the parliamentary questions and other questions raised in the media elsewhere were just brushed off. And it was not explained where that money was spent. Also, the other thing that created revenue for the government to prepare for earthquake was the building amnesties that they introduced, the construction amnesties they introduced over the years. That also brought quite a big amount of revenue into Treasury.
Are you saying that if you, as a builder, paid the government something, the government promised to overlook the consequences of your building collapsing?
Yes, not only builders, it usually comes from the owners as well. It started some years back, long before AKP government. In 1984, for example, there was an amnesty, construction amnesty, to allow people who self-built one-story, single-story houses for themselves in slums, in the outskirts of towns, usually on public land. And they were legalized. People were given deeds for their properties. That's how it started. Usually before elections, this construction amnesty is used as a populist tool to get votes. And it means, literally, people who built illegally, people who failed tests for earthquake proofing, and all other kind of extra bits and pieces they added or they removed, for example, again, a supporting column or something like that. They pay the fine, they pay the registration fee, and then they are legalized. That's what construction amnesty is.
Right. That doesn't sound very clever.
It is highly dangerous. And, you know, some opposition parties also went along with it over the years because they needed the votes. It was very popular, and I think the public really loved it, and they did support it. But there were some opposition parties, particularly the Kurdish majority, HDP, objected to it very strongly, because there's another one pending, actually, just before this earthquake. There was another amnesty pending. I suspect that's not going to happen now, but that's a big problem for Turkey.
So you paint a picture in which we have quite a lot of shoddy building, we have quite a lot of regulations not being met, we have a lot of some unwise building, and in addition to that, we have a kind of culture of amnesty in which safety is not the primary concern. Now, Erdogan has been either PM or president now for the last 20 years. Wasn't part of his original electoral success that he promised that something like this wouldn't happen?
Precisely. And in earlier years, bringing this change to the law and some other steps were taken. But the last 10 years or so, this construction boom plus removing experts from positions of bureaucracy and, of course, in general, rejecting scientific advice and demeaning experts in government, all of those contributed to a very inefficient and endemically corrupt system.
Now, as you've pointed out, it was also aspects of it were also popular because they enabled people to do things that they wanted to do. So how much is the Turkish public now likely to turn around and blame Erdogan for what's happened?
They already started blaming, certainly in the areas that have been affected by this earthquake. But Turkey is a very unpredictable country. The president is promising to start building within a month enough housing for millions of people who lost their properties. Now, that is considered not a very wise thing to do. Again, experts and scientists are warning that this will lead to another disaster later on. But if he can keep up with these promises going through, and of course the media is 90% pro-government, and what they are reporting and what they are saying is very much different than what non-governmental or independent media is saying. But nevertheless, the opposition is stronger and firmer in their response, and they are much more outspoken now. And of course, we have social media, which we didn't have in 1999. Social media, even though the first reaction of the government was to restrict Twitter, which was actually quite a terrible thing to do. People relied, survivors and relief workers relied on Twitter to coordinate and find further survivors. And they restricted it, but people found ways of getting around it. So it's not so easy to get the message PR or damage limitation they seem to be doing so far. And it looks as if the government's main priority really is to protect the state and the administration. And they can only go so far. I think people have a great deal of indignation or even rage, I think, now.
Right. There are elections coming, aren't there, in a few months' time. Predictions, of course, as you suggested, are hazardous. But do you think Erdogan's government will survive this earthquake?
If the election happens when it should, which is by constitution on the 18th of June this year, and if it's not delayed, as the government is asking for it to be delayed by another year, because of the earthquake, and it shouldn't be delayed because the constitutionally only at a time of war the elections could be delayed. If it happens on time, and if it happens with a level of free and fair election conditions, he shouldn't survive. But we'll see if it will be fair and free. And of course, so many times the constitutional rules have been ignored, there is no guarantee it won't be done this time.
One way or another, Ferdevs, Erdogan tends to win elections. How confident are you that his government won't be there after the next one?
I am not confident for the very simple reason. In a democracy with accountability and openness, free and fair election conditions, you could say, after such a big disaster and such a bad state of economy, I would say he should lose. But Turkey is an unpredictable country.
Ferdevs Robinson, what about Syria? Dr. Lina Khatib is director of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. Lina Khatib, we've heard how poor building standards may have led to the very high death rates in Turkey. Is that also true in Syria?
It is partially true in the sense that the northwest of Syria is where millions of internally displaced people from other regions of Syria ended up. And of course, there was no housing for them. So a lot of them ended up living in makeshift constructions or hastily constructed buildings, and many actually still lived in tents. So the mass destruction of the infrastructure is definitely related to the refugee flow and just the fact that they had no choice but to live in these kinds of buildings.
How has Syria's president Bashar al-Assad reacted to this earthquake?
Bashar al-Assad has literally laughed in the aftermath of the earthquake. He was filmed a few days after the earthquake's hit in Aleppo. That was his first public appearance after the earthquakes. And he supposedly went there with his wife to inspect the sites, but he was filmed laughing. And the laughter very much echoes the political sentiment felt by Assad, which is that this earthquake came, and with it comes political opportunities in the eyes of Assad. He and his officials have been calling the international community to lift sanctions on Syria. They have falsely claimed that Western sanctions are hampering the delivery of aid. They are trying to say foreign aid coming to Syria needs to flow through Assad government channels, because this would mean normalization in a kind of de facto way for the Syrian regime. Assad is also boasting about the number of world leaders who have been in touch to express condolences for the Syrian people, because he sees this as an opportunity to say that he is legitimate.
So it's an opportunity for him to come back from being a kind of pariah, as far as he's concerned, and put the blame somewhere else.
Assad is obviously seeing in this an opportunity to get out of international isolation. And of course, he is pretending that the hardship faced by people in the northwest is to do with the opposition holding that area rather than his regime, when actually everyone knows that it is Assad who's responsible for the humanitarian catastrophe that was already there all over Syria, but especially in the northwest, well before the earthquake.
The Syrian government has said that sanctions were increasing the difficulty of the catastrophe. What has America said in response?
The United States has very quickly responded to highlight that US-imposed sanctions target only the Assad regime and people affiliated with the regime and institutions and companies linked to the regime, and that these sanctions, like sanctions imposed by the European Union, do not affect humanitarian delivery because they carry an exemption for the delivery of humanitarian aid. However, the US Department of the Treasury did, a few days later, announce that there will be a temporary lifting of sanctions on transactions going to Syria for earthquake relief. And this, of course, means a temporary lifting of sanctions. And this will allow remittances by people abroad who want to send money to Syria to be able to send money to their loved ones. So it does not necessarily affect the delivery of aid, but it does allow the flow of cash.
How does Russia view the earthquake in terms of the opportunities for Assad and also things like opening more border crossings?
Russia has been adamant that any delivery of aid should happen through Syrian government channels only. And that is why Russia has persistently, whenever the UN had a Security Council meeting to discuss cross-border aid delivery and cross-border crossings, insisted that only one crossing should be opened between Turkey and Syria. And Russia has repeated this position in the aftermath of the earthquake, saying only one border crossing is enough between Turkey and Syria, even though the reality was vividly showing that one border crossing open between Turkey and Syria is not enough for the pace or quantity of aid needed in northwest Syria. So again, Assad is seeing in the earthquake an opportunity, and Russia is very much echoing this sentiment.
I had a UN representative on the radio saying that all he cared about was whether the aid got in, and he didn't really care about the politics of the situation. What do you make of that as a UN position?
Unfortunately, the UN position has been very politicized. I mean, by nature, the UN only deals with member states, and that's why the UN has always dealt with the government of Syria under the leadership of Assad and his regime. So to claim that aid is not politicized is actually a false representation of the reality. The fact is, northwest Syria did not see any aid flow in from the UN until Assad gave the blessing for two more border crossings to be opened between Turkey and Syria. And therefore, many in the Syrian community are criticizing the UN, not just for its slow response, but also for allowing politics to basically be ahead of humanitarian need.
The area of Turkey bordering on this part of Syria has itself been very badly hit by earthquakes. Now, I was just wondering whether that will mean that you just won't see the scale of refugees crossing the border that we've seen in previous crises here.
When it comes to millions of people who have no homes to return to in other places in Syria and have had homes destroyed in northwest Syria, as well as, of course, the Syrian refugees in southern Turkey, these people will need to go somewhere. And it is quite feasible that a number of these people are going to try to move elsewhere as a result. And perhaps once again, Europe might see a wave of refugees coming through Turkey simply because people feel they have no other alternatives.
Lina Khatib, my thanks to her and to Stephen Hicks, Dina Diala and Ferdevs Robinson. And my conclusion, for what it's worth, an earthquake zone is somewhere where eventually a big earthquake will happen. So if corners are cut or preparations not made, then the result one day will be a disaster. It's a universal lesson. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirstine Knight and Daniel Gordon. The editors were Charlotte MacDonald and Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Rod Farker. If you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, where you'll find a whole back catalogue to listen to, including the one on how we get over 50s back to work, or whether they will go back to work, the one on whether there are any quick fixes for the NHS, and the one on how worried we should be about avian flu.
I'm Paris Lees. Welcome to The Flip Side from BBC Radio 4. In each episode, I'll tell two stories from opposite sides of the coin and use science to ask questions about elements of the human experience that we sometimes take for granted.
Turns out that this person that I sublet my apartment to, he was, you know, a scammer.
I feel like now I am the person that I was when I was on the internet at 13.
It's lies and it's covered with lipstick and glitter.
Subscribe to The Flip Side with me, Paris Lees, on BBC Sounds.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.